G'day expats and welcome to another episode of Expat Chat episode 14. My name is Brett Evans. I'm the Managing Director of Atlas Wealth Management in the Europe, Middle East and Africa region. And joined with me today is my colleague and friend, James Ridley, who's the Managing Director for the APAC region. G'day, James.
G'day, Brett. How are you going?
Good, thanks, mate. Yourself?
Yeah, good. Obviously, again, another day, isolation. Obviously, in Australia, we're starting to see the curve beginning to flatten with every daily, I suppose, recorded cases decreasing quite quickly. But I'm not sure we're out of the thick of it yet because we're approaching the long weekend of Easter. And I think there's a lot of concern about whether Australians are going to still have that relaxed attitude going into it or whether they're going to still, you know, abide by the rules, practice social distancing and not leave their houses unless absolutely necessary. So I'm nervous about the weekend that's going to transpire. What about yourself?
Yes, mate. Well, we're in Dubai. We're in 24 lockdown now this week, which, you know, certainly is not the easiest of experiences, and you know, it's certainly testing the infrastructure by way of home deliveries and those sort of things. But you know, we've got to do what we're going to do to get this behind us, and always happy to do the right thing and get through it. So you know, it's quite a bizarre scenario working from your dining room table, which is where this is coming from. And it was a bizarre scenario last Tuesday when we held that global webinar for expats, which we'll include a link to that in the description below.
Sure.
But talking to expats in 52 countries from my dining room table was just a very surreal experience. But that's what this experience is now.
Yeah, exactly right. I think, you know, like I've seen before, a lot of businesses are going to innovate and everyone's working from home. And I think as we come out of this, new business concepts are going to be formed. And at the moment, obviously, you're in a 24-hour lockdown, aren't you? You can't even leave the house just to go for a walk. Is that right?
Can't take the dog for a walk. You can't stretch your legs. So we're pretty lucky. We live in a villa, but really feel for those people living in apartments because virtually their capacity of being outdoors would be on a balcony, and that's if you do have a balcony in your apartment. So, it's certainly thrown up a lot of pain points, but as I said, if we can get through this and put it behind us, then everyone's for the better.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we're talking just before we started about the daily increases just in, I suppose, the UAE, Dubai alone. You know, when you look at that bar graph on that John Hopkins website, it's pretty scary. I mean, I think it was 283, 277, 290, then it's 300 yesterday. Those are huge increases.
They are, and I just hope this, in the early phase, I mean, the UAE was quite aggressive with, you know, sort of tackling these issues, and for a long while our numbers were quite, you know, low,
and they were.
It's only in the last couple of last week really that the numbers have gone through the roof. So, you know, I just hope that Australia's not going to experience the same sort of anomaly, I guess you could say, in the numbers. I said, before the call, I think what's going to save the Australian economy, or save the Australian people anyway, is the fact that everyone's so spread out. Sort of a quarter acre block, and you know, there's not nine people living in one apartment, a family situation. So fingers crossed, when we do the next expat episode, you know, your numbers are still flat and ours are going down.
Yeah, that's right. I think probably the biggest concern is the US at the moment. I was just looking at that graph again. Yesterday, they reported an increase of 32,800. The day before that, it was 29,600. Those are some serious numbers. I'm not sure they get it. They need to take that draconian approach and just pull lockdown 24 hours.
Yeah, look, when this all started to kick up, and you know, I sort of mentioned in the webinar last Tuesday night, and also in our client communications, you know, my concern has always been the US. And the reason being is you don't have that like autocratic type country like China does, that you can just suddenly lock everyone down. You know, in the US, they like to refer to their first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, you know, amendments and freedoms. When you look at how FEMA handled, Hurricane, what was the one that hit New Orleans? The one that hit New Orleans, it took them 5 days to get water to the football stadium. Everyone was there. So, you know, you'd hope they would have learned a lot from them. But given where things are right now, I mean, if you look at you know, there's particular state governors in the US that are actually taking the floor and being more, showing more leadership skills than probably Washington is at times. So, you know, it really is concerning, and certainly, yeah, I really hope they get a handle on it.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting to see the approaches that different countries are taking. I was speaking to some clients in Singapore a few days ago, and they were saying that, yep, they're in full lockdown. Singapore's been great at that approach. And if you're seen being outside, you know, either thrown in jail or they'll take your employment pass and kick you on a plane and see you later. So, you know, some countries do it really, really well, whereas others are just a bit relaxed and they just almost don't have the infrastructure to lock it down.
Yeah, well, the Dubai police came out yesterday because there are people who are still flouting the 24-hour lockdown period here, and this was a massive departure from normal protocol in the Middle East, or especially UAE. You're not allowed to take a photo of someone else and put it on social media. That's actually illegal, and you can virtually get fined, thrown in jail, and or thrown out of the country. And people, a lot of people have had that in the past. Dubai police have done a 180, and they've said if they catch people outside of their house with no permit, because we need to apply for a permit to go buy groceries and those sort of things, they will take a photo of you. They will not blur your face. They will name and shame. So they're actually going to use social media to name and shame people. So, you know, it's, you know, look, some people just don't get it, the seriousness of this. And if that's what it takes, that's what it takes, and I applaud them.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I just, as I mean, everyone's thinking the same thing. How long is this going to last? Is this going to go all the way through to Christmas? Is this only going to last another few more months? I think it probably depends also the seasons that we're going to be experiencing. I mean, you were just talking that it's getting pretty hot in Dubai at the moment.
Yeah, look, it looks like we're going to probably get through the 14, the 40 degree temp in the next day or two. So let's see how COVID-19 likes that. But, been doing a fair bit of research, and the Boston Consulting Group actually did quite a fascinating piece, which I'll once again share in the descriptions below. And I haven't actually shared it with you yet, James, so you're here for the first time as well. So these numbers, bearing in mind, they are a little bit old. So this was as of the 25th of March, but I think it really does provide a very solid, I guess, an unemotional framework as to how this is panning out. So what they've done is they've looked at a large number of countries, and then when the potential lockdown start date would be, when the peak new cases date forecast would be, the potential lockdown end date, and a potential long version of an end down. And what they've done is they've actually used a lot of factors and data. So the first one, the number of inpatient beds per 100,000 people in the population, the number of respiratory diseases per 100,000 people, and the ability to manage an epidemic. And they've gone through and mapped this out. So according to the Boston Consulting Group, they reckon that the peak in the US is getting the first week of May. At the earliest, the states will finish their lockdown, if they are in a lockdown, the second week of June, but in a long scenario, third week of July. Australia, they reckon that our peak cases in Australia will be the second week of May. And if we do go into lockdown, the earliest we'll come out of that will be the fourth week of June, and on the long scenario, the fourth week of July. So I'll certainly share that around with everyone. More than happy to. I think these days people are screaming for just unemotional data to try and get their heads around what's going on. And look, I think, you know, from my own personal experience, you know, I haven't seen my wife and daughters for over a month. And, you know, I think when you do, whether you're separated from family or you're just trying to deal emotionally with these sort of things, when you can sort of almost put a date on these things, it just makes it a little bit easier, you know, to deal with. You can sort of say, rightio, suck it up, princess, have your cup of concrete, you know, just get through till the last week of May, and then life may, slowly start to come back to normal. And I just think we need these sort of... not this hyperbole that goes out there with, you know, the US government sort of saying we're going to be finished by Easter, because it sounds nice, as opposed to this is going to go on for 12 months. You know, I think that just really messes with people's heads. And you just need to have cool, unemotional information just to mentally prepare for it. Because I think the mental aspect is as big as the emotional aspect as well too.
Yeah, that's right. And raw data doesn't lie. And obviously, as that model keeps updating, it's, you know, going to help create more accurate decisions around expectations. Exactly. I think everyone can agree that you just can't take Trump seriously anymore. The amount of times that he contradicts himself, especially around these sort of circumstances, you just, like you said, you lean on local senators.
Yeah, and look, I think what he's doing wrong is he's politicising specialists. You know, he's sort of, any time a specialist talks out, he'll always say, oh, was that person put in during the Obama administration, and, you know, therefore it's a political ploy, you know.
Yeah,
people are so far beyond the political side. Now it's a matter of lives and health, and, you know, everyone needs to listen.
That's right. Listen, let's kick on. I'll talk quickly about today's itinerary.
We'll do our little disclaimer. So yeah. Everyone loves a little disclaimer. We should actually build a jingle for this or something. I don't know. My brother's.
Oh, we probably could.
I should get him to build a disclaimer jingle. But anyway, just for the folks out there watching and listening, the information you're about to hear is general in nature and should not be construed as personal financial advice. Please speak to a specialist before you commit to anything.
Brett, you've got that down pat. Might just have to record you.
That's right, voiceover.
Yeah, that's right. But I suppose today we want to touch on a few things. Obviously, a key one at the moment, especially back in Australia, is the deal with expats, landlords, you know, dealing with your tenants if they're obviously unable to pay rent anymore. And we'll go into a few different scenarios based on that. You know, recent market movements, you know, what's happening at the moment, US, ASX, you know, currencies, those sort of things. And then, you know, what's going on with the MRE? We really haven't heard too much at the moment. Where are we at? And then lastly, I've got quite a large amount or a long list of different questions that have been sent in. Some questions off the back of the webinar as well. So we'll try and hit those, very general in nature, but covering quite a lot of different topics. So we'll dive into it. So first off, obviously talking about expat landlords, you know, and obviously some of the issues that a lot of landlords are facing right now with, I suppose, their tenants not being able to pay rent. I mean, I know it's hit pretty close to home for myself personally.
Yeah, look, and I think, you know, we covered this off on the webinar last Tuesday, but and the government was saying last week, so this is, you know, the early April, when they're talking about this, they'll say they'll have an update for landlords and property owners in two days' time, but we haven't seen anything yet. So unfortunately, we're flying blind there. But do you want to talk about, you know, some practical examples?
Yeah, I'll talk about myself, actually. I mean, okay, yeah. I've got a property that just to give a bit of a live example, I've got a property, it was rented out, and then the individual, the tenant that was living there with their family, they've all been let go, unfortunately. So they can't meet rent, they've got a family to provide for. So, you know, obviously the real estate agents come to me and said, James, what do you want to do? I said, listen, we can put them on a holiday break. I've got a mortgage, but I said, you know, I'm happy to facilitate a 4-week break for them and then, you know, resuming maybe it's 60 or 70% rent. They're based on, I suppose, their current situation, you know, paying Centrelink and getting Centrelink as well as covering off on education costs for the kids, groceries, they still wouldn't be able to afford that rent. So they've actually requested to break the lease. So now, you know, that property is now marketed to be rented out. But the current issue with that and what expats will face if they go through the same thing is that there's no open houses at the moment. So open houses are being done by walkthroughs with the agents, which isn't really generating a lot of interest. And another item which we've seen is that people that are offering those places for rent, you know, they're actually taking maybe a 20 to 30% cut on the weekly rent that they're offering now. And that's still not moving the stock that the agents are saying. You know, rental stock is going up, but it's also not moving even when we're offering it at a significant discount. So it's a sign of, I suppose, the things or the times, especially what we're going to see happening over the coming months. I suppose I did some general research because I wanted to know, okay, well, if I can't tenant that and I'm still paying a mortgage on that, you know, what are the banks saying? So I was like, okay, well, I'll call up a few banks, you know, do a bit of research, see what happens. Firstly, call my own. Said, okay, this is the current situation. You know, it's an investment property, but no longer tenants, you know, the income's not coming through. What's the situation on a mortgage freeze based on what the government's been saying? And they were very helpful, but they just said, we wouldn't recommend it. because if you're going to put your mortgage on hold for 6 months, any interest or repayments that don't get paid now, they get capitalized. So I was like, okay, well, tell me what that means. And they said, well, it means when you recommence your mortgage repayments, they're actually going to be a fair bit higher because you've had 6 months holiday, and it's not like we're just pushing pause on the overall mortgage altogether. It means when we recommence it, your repayment's going to be higher. I was like, well, do you think that's fair based on, you know, obviously the current environment? And obviously they're just client service officers and they don't think it's fair, but because nothing's been legislated, that's the current situation. And most banks are the exact same. You know, you can take a mortgage repayment holiday, but again, you're still going to have to pay catch up.
At the end of the day, banks aren't they, and they want their money back.
That's right. And now the other side, when you're looking at it from a tenant point of view, okay, if a tenant is let go and they can't afford their rent and you agree to a rental holiday, that's okay. But when you don't pay your rent or you offer a rental discount, they are meant to catch it back up because this is something that gets recorded on a rental ledger. Rental ledger is actually something that goes on their credit report. So by not paying rent at the agreed amount or at a discounted rate, it actually can impact that tenant's credit score in the future. This is something that a lot of people aren't aware of. So you've really, if you are going to agree something, it needs to be in writing. That way, you know, it isn't going to impact their, I suppose, their overall credit report. But that's a bit of the situation at the moment. There's no legislation which governs it. ScoMo is just saying, we are expecting tenants and landlords to do the right thing and come to an agreement. Agents that are managing the properties, they've never dealt with this before, so they're really coming back to the property owners and going, well, what do you want to do? So it's a really unusual circumstance, to be honest, and I suppose that's a first-hand experience that I've had.
Yeah, and look, I think, you know, Australia's love affair with property is going to mean these effects and the ripples from this are going to be wide felt. And it's not going to last for 2 weeks or 2 months. You know, this is going to go on for a long period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And just the fact that, nothing's been legislated around the mortgage repayments. Nothing's been legislated around, I suppose, the tenancies. I'm not even sure how they would do that because obviously each individual state governs themselves when it comes to those sort of rental agreements with the RTAs. So maybe that's why something hasn't been legislated yet, because it's actually a state issue. It's not a federal level. You know, federal can say, yep, let's do this, but then it's got to still flow through to the state departments, state governments, to actually have something actioned. But at the moment, you know, from my own experience and understanding, is it is still left up to the land, the owners and obviously their tenants, and negotiating through the agents. If you've got a good agent, they'll come to some sort of agreement and help you sort of negotiate something with the renter. But I suppose a lot of the concerns around that right now is that, you know, if I've got a bad tenant in there and they're just trashing the place because, you know, they're not working, they're at home all the time, you know, if I want to evict them, you know, what can I do there? Because there's a freeze on evictions.
Yeah.
So that's a sort of another red herring where people just don't know what to do. Realistically, obviously, if they're damaging the property, you know, you'd have the police involved and have the ability to actually remove that person or those tenants because they're damaging the property. That's quite normal. But these are the sort of quite a few unknowns that we're experiencing right now.
And look, I think that's a great segue into talking about the main residence exemption, and just to give watchers and listeners an update on what's going on there. We won't go into what MRE is because the last 3 years we've pretty much ad nauseum talked about it. But and look, if you don't know what it is, just type in main residence exemption expat, Australian expat, into Google, and you'll get a plethora of articles, including ours. Just to update everyone, obviously 30 June deadline is still there. And just to give you a bit of feedback on what we're doing in the background right now, late last month we wrote to 7 MPs and senators, including Josh Frydenberg, who's the treasurer, and also Michael Sukkar, who's the assistant treasurer as well too. So, you know, virtually we called for them to extend everything by 6 to 12 months. At least 6, but ideally 12, because at the moment with stage 2 restrictions nationally, the biggest problem we're seeing right now is, you know, people can't do open homes, people can't do inspections, and virtually everything's slow to a crawl in terms of property sales. So how are expats meant to be able to sell their property when they can't?
Well, that's right.
You know, there's no buyers and sellers there. So
the stock's not clearing, and it's not, obviously, it's, you know, people trying to sell their houses via auction, via a webinar, that's all well and good, the open houses, but it's not the same. And obviously you're going to see it happen, and that's why we're going to see a huge drag on the property market. You know, people are already saying, yeah, prices are falling. They're falling quite quickly. And you know, likely mentioned in the webinar, having that sort of L-shaped recovery, which is going to take a while because the capital's going to come from somewhere. So at the moment, we're 9th of April today. So, you know, 2 and a bit months to obviously look at selling the property if we're going to sell it. Other than that, you know, the options are pretty limited.
Look, it is, and I'll include a link below in the description to obviously our submissions to all these MPs and senators. And virtually we, you know, outline expats have only had since the 9th of December last year to do anything, combined with the fact now you've got travel bans, so expats can't travel, and those who can travel, get back in the country, have to self-quarantine for 14 days. They can prepare.
Well, they're using hotels. They're using hotels for that now as well. You can't even, you know, go and stay in your own unit or whatever. They're forcing you in those hotels. And you're right. Sorry, I cut you off there, but you're talking about preparing properties now for the sales, aren't you?
And then we've heard of scenarios of people who actually have tenants who test positive for COVID-19. So therefore, you can't even do one-on-one inspection walkthroughs with an agent because the tenant's got COVID-19. So, you know, to me, this is a perfect storm. It wouldn't be outside of the government's ability to extend this. Essentially what they need to do is just make an announcement, and then when Parliament resumes in August, they pass through the legislation to provide the appropriate time frame. But you know, we're going to get quite loud over the coming weeks, you know, just to really try and give this as much airplay as possible, because it really is going to become an issue for a lot of people. You know, I'm talking to people, and I'm sure you are, on a daily basis, who are, you know, beside themselves trying to adjust their financial circumstances in line with the legislation, and they can't.
Yeah, exactly right. It's just, I don't know, we don't have really a playbook for this one. And I think a lot of expats are just going to be stuck wondering, you know, I can't do anything. So, you know, the fact that you might have tenants that are test positive for COVID-19 as well, it's going to act as a deterrent, to be honest. People aren't going to want to buy that place because they're going to want someone to go in there professionally, clean it head to toe, in case it's, you know, it's left on anything that's within the house and survives. So it's a huge issue. You know, if they can obviously offer 6-month freezes on evictions and those sort of things, why can't they offer 6 to 12 months to increase, and I suppose in the transition period?
Look, they can, and to me, they haven't done it because they haven't even thought about it personally. You know, we've seen a lot of expat laws go through with no consideration to expats, and it's up to us to make them aware of it.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, a lot of the stimulus that they have announced, and this is a bit of a sidestep about JobKeeper, JobSeeker payments, one of the caveats for those is usually that you must be an Australian resident. So I know there's a lot of expats that have been impacted by that, whether they're running a business from afar, but you need to be an Australian resident to actually still be able to lodge and apply for those kind of benefits. We've received a few questions in the past.
Yeah, sorry, I was just going to say, yeah, and this is just hot off the press as of 4 minutes ago. I've been approaching the ATO regarding qualification on the early access to super. Because in a lot of the policy documents they've released so far, there's nothing to say whether you need to be a resident or a non-resident and so on and so forth. So I've gone down 3 channels which you can approach with the ATO. One of them is their online community. And so you'd think this has a bit of credibility. And their response sort of is still very vague. So essentially, this lady's name is Sue. She said, Australian citizens and residents need to meet one or more of the following requirements, which we know what the requirements are. So she does specifically refer to citizens and residents. But then she says, there is no mention of residing in Australia to apply. There is more information on that website and details about registering your interest at MyGov. So she sort of says in the first line, Australian citizens, residents, you know, so obviously you need to be there.
Yeah.
But then in the last line is their mention of residing in Australia. So, you know, we'll keep trying to hunt that one down because we do know there are a lot of expats overseas who, you know, are definitely affected by this. And from our point of view, you know, we want to make sure we're providing strong compliant advice to make sure that people know how to navigate this time.
That's right. And I think probably the early release of the super is probably the only thing that potentially expats might be out of touch, but again, it's all done through the MyGov system, Centrelink, exactly. And applying, and let's hope that there's not really you're currently an Australian tax resident or anything like that. So, exactly. You know, it seems like they're still making it up as they go, much with anything. But, I mean, moving on, you know, touching base on recent market movements, obviously we've come to a close of March now. We're on our way through April, and, you know, I think February to March, I think it was the fastest and quickest bear market on record, but we've seen, obviously, a bit of a change as well in March.
Look, it's been, and there's quite a lot to explain what's going on and what's causing this. And once you go through and look at the numbers, you know, it sort of makes sense. But to give both the watchers and the listeners a bit of an insight, just on the Australian market alone, total volume by computer-driven trades is approximately 40%. In the US, it's about 60%. So these computers are both, you know, algorithm-driven, based on certain metrics that are fed into the program, but also to sentiment-driven as well too. And what we sort of see in these sort of markets, and you know, it didn't receive a lot of press, which is probably a good thing, but the volume in one particular day was the Friday, three Fridays ago, I think it was, and the volume was so high in terms of number of trades going through the system that luckily, it was a Friday, and all the back offices for the brokers and the ASX were able to clear those trades. They didn't clear them until 9 p.m. on Sunday night.
Jesus.
So if that day or that massive volume day had occurred on a Tuesday, for the first time in the whole ASX history, there may have been a chance that the normal settlement terms of T+2 may not have occurred. And ASIC actually called in all the major brokers on a call and said, you must reduce your volume by 25%.
Oh, my gosh. There you go.
So how do you tell a client, don't trade? So these are the sort of these unique scenarios that we're sort of experiencing at the moment. And, you know, certainly when you look at, you know, the rule book, it's been thrown out a long time ago. But, you know, certainly looking here right now, something I've been tracking very closely is we look at, from a technical analysis, where the markets are. And, you know, there was a very clear line that extended from the 17th of March at 5293 on the ASX 200. And it hit again on the, I'm just looking at the screen here, 8th of April. And we broke through it today. Now, some people say, great, okay, we're out of this, you know, pullback, it's on again. My concern is, if we want to compare apples and oranges, this to me is a bigger event than the GFC.
Yeah.
It's a different event, but it's a bigger event. During the GFC, the market fell 50%.
Yep.
We're down, I think, on the ASX 200 about 22% or 21% right now. So when you look at, you know, sort of, you know, just once again, trying to remove emotion out of these things, are we fully priced in? You know, that's the big question. And to me, the real catalyst is going to be this month. We're going to find out from companies upgrading their earnings. Oh, sorry, not upgrading, but updating their earnings. We're going to find out what the true stake is in the US. Obviously, the US economy is a beast. And the world economies do tend to march off that as well. We're going to find out more whether Chinese manufacturers are back to business. If they are, that's certainly good for the Australian economy. But are they really back to business, or are we going to see more flare-ups? So I don't think we're out of the woods just yet. I think, you know, this month is going to be the telling month of what the, you know, almost pulling the curtains and looking out the window, you know, what will be in the coming months ahead.
Yeah, well, I think you're spot on there in terms of going through, I suppose, updated earnings guidance. You've already seen it early this week, the banks sort of got slammed. But then you look at how today closed going into the Easter long weekend, we're up, I think, 3.5% for the day, which I think goes, we just had a good four-week run, surprisingly. But, I mean, you look at March, I think they said in terms of volumes, there's been 16 times as much money being rotated out of cash and fixed interest into equities. So a lot of people thinking, okay, we've bottomed out, let's climb back in, but I don't think we're there yet. There's a lot of thematic investing going on, so that obviously, you know, targeting companies which are pretty resilient through these times, Coles, Woolworths, Wesfarmers, Ansell, those guys, they're doing really, really well, and they'll continue doing really, really well. But then on the opposite side, you've seen a huge inflows into these bear funds. You know, they're still betting on that the market is still bottoming out. And I think as an example, one of the bear funds that's I think BetaShares uses, it's gone from 250 million to 750 million in about 4 weeks. That's huge. It's more than Telstra trading in terms of volume. So it just goes to show that a lot of investors don't think we're there yet. Whereas, it's unusual, but I think you're right. April is going to be a telltale for probably the next few months after that.
Yeah, and look, I think you hit the nail on the head. When it comes to, you know, and I've been through my fair share of, you know, sort of economic events, you know, September 11, Asian financial crisis, GFC and so forth. And what tends to happen when you do get this fall is the first rush of money tends to be mum and dad investors. And then, but I don't think we've seen the smart money come in yet. And look, you always got to be careful when you read market commentary by certain people, because they can also be talking their own book as well. You might hear a very famous investor say, you know, he thinks there's more to fall, but that's because he's trying to get in himself, or other way around. You know, and it happens all the time.
Listen to me. The bottom's not there yet, so I can get in.
Exactly. So he wants people to sell off so he can get in. And then he'll come out one day and say, okay, we've hit the bottom. And then everyone starts
to come in. It looks great as well.
It looks great. It looks like a genius. So I'm just telling you, know, watchers and listeners, that happens all the time. It's called talking your own book. And so you've always, you know, that's one of the reasons why we love data. You know, strip away the emotion, binary ones and zeros.
That's right.
It just tells you what it is. And, you know, it's funny how all of our social media feeds have now been filled by property spruikers. When you look at, there was an interesting article in the Financial Review yesterday, which, by the way, does not make any money from the property industry, hence the reason why they're happy to give us the warts and all view on the property market. And they said mortgage growth actually went backwards in February before all this kicked off.
Yeah, it did.
You know, so it was only the home buyers that went up. The first home buyers. Everyone else, you know, owner occupiers and investors. So property was already starting to grind that down. And there's always a delay in the data. So March's data doesn't get released until April. April's data doesn't get released until May and so on. So when we saw March's data, you know, suddenly all the property brokers came out and said, hey, look, property prices went up in March. But what they're not looking at is, there was probably a slight increase at the beginning, but there's also a dovetail. But also because the volumes are just not there.
Yeah.
So it's not reflecting the market. And was it last weekend, there was meant to be 2,384 properties go to auction in Sydney and Melbourne.
Auction.
Yep. Only 74 went through. So, you know, for those people out there who are data nerds and statisticians, that number of 74 is not statistically significant enough to determine what the whole market is doing.
And no, it's too small a sample size, you're right.
Exactly, and this is what's going to happen with property over the next 3 to 6 months. It's going to be death by a thousand cuts. And the reason being is, you know, if you've got a tenant in whose lease expires in September and you can't kick them out and you desperately need to sell that property, are you going to try and sell that property while stage two restrictions are in place? No, you're not. So you got to call the bank and say, I need a 6 month holiday. And then once that tenant's out, then you'll kick them out. Then you'll start to sell, because now you're going to start to play catch up on your cash flows. And that's, you know, my gut tells me, I mean, I don't think we're going to see the true extent with what's happening with property until probably August, September.
Well, I mean, a lot of people are calling this a deep U-shaped recession, or I suppose V-shaped recession, where we're in it right now and it might obviously get a bit worse before it gets better, but we will bounce back pretty quickly. And there's been plenty of examples through history of that.
Yeah, look, it's one thing, and it's always, it's the same mantra for rising markets as well as falling markets. You know, when you go through these sort of scenarios, you do really find out who's been swimming naked when the tide goes out. And this is exactly what's happening with companies right now, as you work out, you know, are they, you know, zigging or zagging, is this company going to go bust or not? We're still working that out. But on the recovery side, some companies and sectors will recover quicker. And that's assuming these companies have been affected. I mean, we've already run through a good list of companies that are actually doing well. Talking to a client the other day who works in logistics, And he reckons that Coles and Woolies, their turnover's gone up by 200%.
Wouldn't surprise me. All the panic buying. God.
Exactly. So, you know, they're doing well, but there are businesses which they'll feel a bit of short-term pain, and that's been priced into the, you know, their share price. But they'll rebel once, then it's a matter of flicking the switch and everyone's back to work again and so forth. However, when you look at, say, the travel and tourism sector, and if you go back to September 11, it took 2 to 3 years for people to feel confident to fly on a plane again after September 11. You know, I'm not saying it's going to be 2 to 3 years, but it's going to be at least 1 or 2. Certainly the cruise ship industry, they've got a PR disaster. You know, no one's going to want to go on a cruise ship.
So, well, you hear everything that's... I was just going to say, you hear everything that's come about on the Australian side about that Ruby Princess, how, you know, looking at criminal charges and proceedings and all these other things about just the spread of, I suppose, COVID-19 from that, I suppose, epicenter. It's ridiculous. And all the deaths that have come about from it as well.
Bingo. And that's, you know, I think I saw some sort of analysis and they said 1 in 10 cases in Australia can be traced back to the Ruby Princess.
Ridiculous. And it just goes, I mean, obviously a disaster for the company, but a disaster for us as well in terms of border controls. And obviously they've towed the line now. They've pretty much just said all cruise ships get out of Australian waters.
Yeah. And there's no Australians on those boats anyway, so they don't need to be there.
You know, exactly
they can,
right.
They can do what the airlines are doing in those transit points, like Singapore, for example. You can't transit through Singapore, but you can stay on the plane. They can refuel you. So, you know, obviously these guys need fuel and provisions, but there's no reason to commingle, you know, the guests of the ship with the general populace.
Yeah, that's right. And I suppose, you know, in terms of the tourism industry, I think it's going to, I personally think it's going to take at least 18 months for that to sort of go from a crawl to obviously 100 kilometres an hour again. And those companies are feeling it. Webjet, Flight Centre. I think Flight Centre was in some serious trouble, but they've done that capital raising and it seems to be a sigh of relief. And now their outlook looks okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll wait and see what happens over the next 6 to 12 months. But I suppose moving into a few other topics now, and I wanted to discuss after, you know, talking about what's been going on in the market, you know, I've got quite a long list of different questions that have come about after the webinar. So I hope you don't mind, but we'll go through them all. There's a few things in there, things we've already talked about. And I mean, the first one was this question here, do you think the proposed tax cuts for landlords who agree to waive rent are likely to provide any assistance in practice to overseas landlords? I'm not sure of the tax cuts that this individual is talking about. Have you heard anything regarding tax cuts for landlords? That might be to do with commercial property.
The federal government did say last week that they are going to bring in tax relief. So maybe it's intermingled words, but once again, I mean, for Australian residents or Australian non-residents, we don't know anything yet, unfortunately. And, you know, you and I are watching this like a hawk, and as soon as we do know something, we'll be out there, you know, sort of letting everyone know. Surely if it's built within, you know, say the federal legislative tax laws, you know, you'd think it would apply to expats.
Of course.
And obviously at the state level, whether it's got to do with land tax or those sort of considerations, you'd think it would extend to expats as well. But, yeah, we don't know, unfortunately.
No.
So it's watch this space.
Yeah, exactly right. Making up as they go. I think at the moment everyone's tuning in on Sunday night to watch Scott Morrison populate our TVs, and we sort of just hang on every word to see, you know, what's the next level of restrictions that are going to be put in place.
Yeah.
So we'll see what comes about. I mean, as an example, in terms of beaches and coastal areas, they've actually closed all the car parks on the beach. Obviously only side bits, street parking. So they're just trying to obviously deter people from going to the beach and doing all those things that people normally would, you know, in the Australian lifestyle. So that's a bit of an example already. But moving forward onto another question, this one's about industry super funds, and it is something that, Brett, you talked about at length when you were discussing the webinars about the liquidity issues that we've seen and the write-downs.
Yep.
Did you want to give a quick summary on that? And I'll go into the question about the person's asked, you know, what action should members of these funds be weighing up in light of this, maybe considering moving or doing something else, going to cash, you know, what's the issue with industry super funds that we've seen that came out of the Australian Business Review?
Yeah, so there's essentially two issues that we see. The first issue is that when you are classified as a type of investor, that classification is based on your attitude to risk, your appetite for risk, as well as your investment horizon or time frame. And yep. You know, to run everyone through the five basic categorizations, you got defensive, moderate defensive, balanced growth, and high growth. So most people sort of fit in the balance range, and it's well documented and well respected that a balanced portfolio has 60% growth and 40% income. The industry funds were pushing the friendship in terms of their categorization, and a lot were running actually 70-30 and some 80-20. And yeah. Not that I saw this, but I heard someone
saying 90-10.
So, and that's for balance. So what it meant was when they were reporting their numbers through the bull market we had post the GFC, of course the industry funds are going to be outperforming because they've invested more in high growth. But what they've done now is they've exposed their members to more risk that they may not have been aware. So that was the first issue we had. The second issue was the high propensity of the industry funds to using unlisted assets. Now, an unlisted asset is like a building, a toll road, an airport, you name it. And their argument for this was super is a long-term, you know, game, and we're making 40-year investments in these assets, which is fine, as long as that's part of the metrics of being able to comply with APRA, the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, in terms of meeting your liquidity requirements. But the problem is, as these guys got bigger and bigger, they started to put more and more money in the unlisted side than the listed side. With, I think it was, I read yesterday, REST, one of the retail hospitality type industry funds.
Super fun. Yep.
40% of their assets are in unlisted assets.
Gosh. So what kind of issue does that create when people are changing investment options in these times?
So the problem they've got is twofold. The first one is, and we saw this happen in the GFC, and unfortunately it's playing out again, I hope we didn't see this, is obviously a share market reacts instantaneously to the second and reprices risk accordingly. Unlisted assets relies on the owner of the asset to reprice those assets. So everything fell 30% and the industry funds came out and said, oh, this has fallen 7.5%. Straight away, red flags go up. You know, we know it's all fallen on more than that. Now they're starting to revise those figures. But the problem they've got is twofold. Now, even in a normal market, not including the early access to super provisions, in a normal market, people are going to rotate in and out of cash. Or rotate either from being invested to cash or changing their investment model. The problem they've got is for those people who are panicking going to cash, it means that they can't sell down their unlisted assets. They have to actually sell their listed assets at a low price where we are right now to fund those redemptions. So the industry funds actually have to sell out at the bottom to pay out. Whereas if they weren't so greedy and if they held more cash, which they should have, they would have been able to fund all this. Now, you put on top of that like a turbocharger, now people are, you know, have got this $20,000 ability to withdraw early access to super. And, you know, it's interesting to see out there the numbers have been thrown around. So the industry funds are saying, oh, look, it's going to be, you know, 26 to 35 billion in terms of people will pull out. Those people who are independent and emotional, they're saying 65 billion. And all the industry funds right now are coming back saying, oh, we've got enough, got enough. And we saw this from Host Plus. So Host Plus up until Thursday last week, what's today? So that'd be the 7th of April. They're saying we've got plenty of liquidity, everyone relax, we're fine. Late Friday night, they snuck in and changed their terms and conditions on their balance fund to enable them to be able to freeze redemptions, and also to, if you request the redemption, you will be given the price of that asset when the redemption is unfrozen, not at the price that you requested. So say for example, practical example, Telstra. Telstra right now is sitting at $3.20 a share. Now, if you request today a redemption, but your redemption's frozen for, say, a month, and in that time Telstra goes down to 280, then you'll get paid out at 280, not at 320.
Oh, gosh.
So, yeah, it's you know, to me, there's a lot of skullduggery going on in the background, and these guys, I think, have really been caught out. I think there's going to be hell to pay by the trustees. You know, you and I both know, when we run quite a lot, quite, you know, quite a, quite a lot of super funds for expats. And when we run them, you know, we can generate liquidity like that. You know, yeah, and it was proven on us as providers to our clients to be able to you know, meet those needs no matter what is happening. You know, we've seen this event unprecedented. I guarantee in the next 10, 20 years, there's going to be another unprecedented event. So when you manage money, you always need to have these black swan unprecedented events in the back of your mind to be able to go to clients. Clients need money, bank, there you go. You know, if we had a client that came to us that said, you know, ATO comes out and clarifies, yes, we can, you know, get access as a non-resident and I've lost my job overseas and I need this money, guess what?
Yeah.
5 days. Simple.
Yep.
You know, no redemption fees and stuff. So to you know, my mind, we're seeing them operating in a totally different tangent, which is incredibly dangerous for a lot of their members.
Didn't a lot of the industry super funds, didn't they, I suppose, knock on the door of the Fed or the RBA and say, we need some help with liquidity? And they just turned them away? They said, no. Nope. Yeah.
So virtually they went to Canberra. And according to them, cap in hand, according to others, not so. More arrogant than anything. And they said, we don't want to have to sell down our listed investments to fund redemptions. So therefore, we want the Reserve Bank to provide us with liquidity and a facility to be able to draw on that. And then as the share prices go back up again, then we'll sell down and repay back the Reserve Bank. But people are paying them to manage money.
Yeah.
People aren't paying them as a charity or a government organisation. You know what I mean? So to me, they just need to own it. They really, pardon the French, they screwed the pooch.
Yep. Yeah, and I'm sure we'll see a lot of outflows out of the industry super funds probably in the next few years as they realise this issue that's come about. It always happens.
Look, it is. And I think it's something that people have realised, if not yet, when they start to get their statements and start to look at the, you know, their holdings, it's going to be too late.
Yeah. Yeah, the revised write-downs, absolutely. Let's move on to another question. Now, this one is about a UK tax resident, so an Aussie expat residing in the UK. So I have an Australian share portfolio as a foreign resident for tax purposes, as well as an Australian interest earning bank account. I failed to notify them that I'm a foreign resident. Foreign resident just means non-resident. How do I meet my tax obligations up until now, as my dividends and interest payments have not had withholding tax applied? I'm a bit surprised in that one, because you would think that they've been doing some tax lodgements each year, but by the sounds of it, they haven't done anything. They might not have even declared that they're a non-resident. They've just gone.
I think you got two issues there. First one will be deemed disposal. You know, if they don't know about the non-resident classification on the account, I guarantee they don't know about deemed disposal, because not many people do.
Yep.
So first one is deemed disposal, which means they're still accruing capital gains tax, even though it's a non-taxable Australian property. Second one is they're not having the appropriate non-resident withholding tax being deducted from their dividends, which means essentially they're holding money back from the ATO. And, you know, this week alone, I've had, because we addressed this in the webinar last Tuesday, I've probably spoken to about 10 different people who have ComSec accounts using their brother's or sister's or parents' address. And their ComSec accounts are actually categorised as Australian resident. And after the webinar last Tuesday night, the first thing they did, well, not the first thing, but one of the things they did quite quickly was to actually contact ComSec to say, is my account down as a non-resident? And they said, no. So what it means
No, I'll let you finish, Brent.
Yeah, so virtually what it means is if they haven't properly declared income, Australian taxable income, because the way dividends work is the dividends are taxed at source. Before the share registry pays the dividend to you, they look at your address and says, okay, Brett's in Dubai. Dubai has no double taxation with Australia. So therefore, we need to deduct 30% from that dividend if there are no franking credits attached.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's, you know, the law. So who are holding especially unfranked income from portfolios and also cash in the bank, they're essentially withholding tax from the ATO, which we know the ATO doesn't like that.
No, that's right. And I mean, if it's quite a large amount of tax, there could even be general interest charges applied to it if there's a few financial years outstanding. And general interest charges, they don't operate like normal interest charges. You know, they're going to be paying anywhere between 8 to 11% on those. So it just, I mean, it feeds into one of these other questions. Are expats able to open brokerage accounts like CommSec and NabTrader? Well, not usually. If you're a non-resident, the product disclosure statement of those should only be received in Australia, and that's the biggest issue they have. Another issue they have is if you're residing in the US, having to deal with and put up with common reporting standards and FATCA. As soon as they know you're a US tax resident, they're just going to show you the door. They're going to say, sorry, can't do it. And a lot of people, as you've just mentioned on the webinar, will use Australian addresses, but it means that those shares that they're holding, the dividends they're receiving, aren't categorised correctly, and therefore the double taxation agreement between those countries aren't applied correctly, and therefore no withholding tax is actually taken out, and it means we have tax outstanding, which again means we have to do our tax returns when sometimes we wouldn't normally have to, because tax would be withheld.
Round and round we go. Yeah.
Exactly right. It's a cycle. Anyway, we could probably keep going on that one, but let's move on.
Let me skip you one through a couple of solutions for that, because people are saying, yep, help, what do I do? You know, it's all good us to sort of say, you know, here's the problem, but sometimes I think we've got to find the solution. And speaking from experience, and we've done that with three new clients this week. So essentially what's happened is they've got CommSec accounts. They've got about anywhere between 50 and 200,000 sitting in those accounts. They are classified as Australian resident. So the steps you need to put in place straight away, contact your accountant to get him to declare that income. Second thing is you cannot kick the can down the road. So what you can do with a investment portfolio is what's called an in specie transfer. So if CommSec will not change your account to a foreign account, which I had one yesterday, they flat out refused. What we're going to do is we're going to pick up those holdings and move them across into an account which is non-resident compliant, still in Australia. We use a number of platforms for our clients, and then you can keep going. But ignorance is not bliss, and you know, you do need to address these issues, especially if you are going to be overseas for longer than 12 months. You know, certainly if you return back to Australia tomorrow, yeah, you just go back and pick up the CommSec account and off you go and do some back lodgements and happy days. But for those people who are going to be overseas for longer than 12 months, you do need to deal with this.
That's right. And I mean, just I suppose another item to address there, non-residents do not get franking credits refunded to them. And this is a scenario I had a few years ago where a non-resident somehow was getting franking credits refunded to them from a large share portfolio. They've been receiving franking credit refunds for the last 10 years. It honestly scared the shit out of me, to be honest, because I was like, that's not correct. Who's been lodging your tax returns? And they just said, oh, just my parents take care of it. And they weren't using an accountant. It was just self-lodging. So I said, listen, you need to go and speak to this accountant. It's quite likely that you'll have to either repay the tax or I don't even know how they're going to go about it, because usually you can only amend up to four previous financial years.
That's right.
So, so it was one of those red herring situations where I was baffled, because again, non-residents do not get franking credits refunded to them. It just means that that income is tax exempt, so you do not need to report it in a tax return, compared to say an unfranked dividend, where if an unfranked dividend doesn't have any withholding tax taken out of it, then it is something that will need to be declared in a non-resident Australian tax return, because then you'll pay the tax through that system. So that was just an unusual circumstance, but I just wanted to put that out there in the event for some reason you're receiving franking credit refunds when you really shouldn't be, if you're declared as a non-resident.
The only exception to that is if you're receiving franking credit refunds inside super, because it's a closed environment. So it's one of the strategies we use for our clients where we manage our super accounts, is any unused franking credits, which obviously tax at 30%, super income tax is only 15%. Because it is a closed environment, the ATO actually puts checks back into our clients' super accounts for unused. Yeah. So that's the only time you'll get it.
Yeah, exactly right. And that usually happens in between September to November, because that's by then, most super funds, their trustees and administrators have actually lodged all the returns with the ATO. Okay, another question here. It's talking about the MRE. I know we didn't want to go into it, but let's do it. Come on, it's a short question. What happens to capital gains tax exemption if you sell your property after 30th of June when you go back to Australia and you are a normal resident again? So I suppose in that scenario, they're returning and residing and becoming a normal Australian tax resident again?
As long as they return within 6 years of departing, they'll get full access to the main residence exemption.
That's right.
If they've been overseas for 10 years, then four of those 10, they won't. So, and it's quite a complex calculation that, you know, a number of factors are put into it. So it's not a matter of 0.4 or 40% of the gain is taxable. No. There's quite a lot more than that. But long story short. Yeah. And I actually responded on one of the Facebook groups last night. There was people out there, you know, sort of saying, oh, as long as you return back to Australia, you don't pay any. No, you do, if you have been overseas for longer than 6 years.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think on that question, I think the toughest, I suppose, answer that a lot of people want, well, how long do I need to be back in Australia for me to meet the resides test and be a normal Australian tax resident? Where there isn't actually guidance out there which is going to tell you how to be a normal Australian tax resident to avoid tax. So, yeah. So it's, you know, look at the residency criteria right now, you know, 183-day rule, you know, your circumstances meet that, that someone's moved back to Australia permanently. You've got your gym memberships, you've got your, you either moved back into your former main residence or you've got a lease again, you're renting, you know, you signed up to your internet providers.
Yeah.
Exactly right. Working again normally. So there's no one size fits all there. It's circumstantial. But again, taking that a step further, the Commission for Taxation is going to be leaning on rule part 4A. Is that anti-avoidance rule?
Yes, anti-avoidance rule, yep, part 4A. Yep.
So they can audit up to 4 previous financial years in the event you're back for, say, 12 months and then you're gone again. And you've sold a property worth a few million and go, oh, well, hang on. You know, there's a bit of tax that we probably should have had access to, but we can see what's happened here. So be careful there. But that's going into it now. This one's more about the Australian dollar. I'll lean on you here, Brett. Do you expect the Aussie dollar to drop less than 50 cents? Jeez.
It would. This whole issue would have to spiral out of control. The only way I see it getting below 50 would be China not restarting and potentially COVID numbers quadrupling from their peak. Yeah, and the reason I say that, you virtually need to have a whole shutdown for a longer period of the global economy and to people take a risk-off approach. So they just go to panic, they just go to cash, and US is, I think it's 88% in terms of being on one side of the foreign exchange transfer, like 88% of all transfers involve US dollars. So it is the global currency, and if you're really panicking and the four horse in the apocalypse come around the corner, you are going to go to US dollars. So in that case, that's called a risk-off approach. They just take no risk at all. They're not even invested. They're just holding cash. That's the, and China was not to you know, refire up their factories. That's the only time I could see it getting below 50.
Yeah, okay. So quite a few events would have to lead up to that taking place before that happens. Yeah. So, and we'd see it being built in, you know, each week as it starts to take place. Yeah. Okay, another question here. They've even put in the question, this may be a silly question, but where are the governments getting the money from for the relief efforts in terms of the stimulus packages that release? And how is that money going to be recovered once the pandemic is over? This is a pretty good question.
Yeah, no, it's actually, it's quite, and like I said last Thursday night, it's quite a simple answer. So ignoring COVID-19, the pandemic and everything, you know, governments issue bonds, and the reason they issue bonds is they go out to the market and says, you know, say we would like to borrow $1 billion and we'll pay you this rate of return for this period. And the reason they do that is because the government doesn't get all their revenue on the 1st of January. They will get it over a period of the year and obviously culminating and building up into the later part of the year. So essentially those cash reserves build up and they use that to pay down a previous bond, and they got the new bond that funds that. So it's sort of like an inverted curve. And that's a normal part of the market. You know, you might have heard of the term, everyone's probably heard of the term bonds. You know, so bonds are either government bonds or corporate bonds. And it's virtually just the company or the government going out to the market to say, hey, I need this money. I'm in exchange for your money. I'm going to give this rate of return for this period. And then after that, here's your money back.
Yep.
What they're doing right now is exactly the same, but just obviously on a lot larger scale. Now, what sort of helps them is the government, with interest rates where they are right now, both domestically and internationally, can borrow money very, very cheaply. Now, if you go back and look in the past of issues that have been occurring, the issues have been, you know, paying incredibly high rates of interest, and therefore they've got this massive debt burden with interest saddling up on that. Whereas at the moment, with obviously official cash rates in the US is zero and Australia 0.25, guess what? You know, the government go out there and borrow a lot of money very cheaply, and because there's no other alternatives, investors who are hungry for yield will take them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, that clarifies that. I mean, does this, you know, with them obviously issuing all these bonds, does that tie into obviously, you know, whenever the government's talking about the budget, the surplus, the deficit, you know, where are we going to be for the next 24, 36, 48 months?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think, you know, like we were discussing on the call before we, you know, we started, you know, obviously the budget's been blown back to October, and they're not going to really know, you know, what the P&L looks like for the country until at least then. Yeah. So to me, it's going to be, I mean, in terms of how they're going to, you know, take their next level, I don't know, to be honest with you. Yeah, they're going to obviously have to me, cut back on a lot of things, a lot of their expenditure, a lot of the deferrals around the side to start to pay down the debt, and it's going to take a hell of a long time to repay it.
That's right. And I think, to be honest, I think Scott Morrison has actually done a really good job through this. You know, he's the one that has to make the hard decisions that no one wants to make, and he's copped a bit of criticism, to be honest, but his popularity probably in the last 6 weeks has gone up through the roof. I think he could hold office for quite a while.
Was it a 10-year high, I think? You know, it's the highest approval rating for a Prime Minister in 10 years.
Yeah, so I'm trying to think. Does that go back to Howard? I think it does.
It would be. It would be Johnny Howard, yeah. Yeah, I think we're with Johnny.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And, you know, I would not have his job for all the money in the world. You know, you're trying to battle against an invisible force. And, you know, the ramifications, like you and I've discussed, you know, every day, just immense, and they go in the most obtuse directions, and you think, wow, I never thought that would happen, and never thought this would happen.
Yeah.
So it's it's really, you know, it's really showing where our strengths are and weaknesses are.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll transition to two final questions, Brett, just as we wind up the episode. This one's a good one. If we sell a property over the next few months, if you can, we'll be holding off buying for at least 3+ months. What do you suggest doing with the cash from the sale, given the volatility of the market? Okay, well, we're talking about a 3 to 6 month term. I think the answer is pretty obvious. There's not many options.
Straight to the bank. And to give everyone a bit of peace of mind too, the banks, the government guarantees Australian bank accounts up to $250,000. So if you really are worried, you can put $249,999 in the Australian bank account. And if that bank were to fold, you would be covered by the federal government. Obviously, if you have more than $249,999, you are going to need to spread it across multiple banks.
That's right. And I have a few clients that are in that boat as well. They've signed up to 6 different banks, and it just seems excessive. But I guess, you know, when they're read into it, especially through these unusual times, they want to take on that extra protection, which is excellent. Last one. When transferring funds back to Australia, is it still recommended to transfer in amounts less than $10,000?
Yeah, I was so excited. $10,000
amount.
I was so excited when this was asked last Tuesday because I see this on a daily basis and I go, finally.
Custom card, surely.
Yeah, I've got an excuse. And just for the record, unequivocally, the $10,000 rule does not apply to online transfers. It applies to cash deposits at banks and carrying physical currency into the country. The Australian government department who tracks all fund flows in and out of Australia, they watch a dollar like they watch $100 million. So if you transfer $9,999.99, guess what? You have just put a big target on yourself because you are going to get zapped. And the reason being is no one transfers such a random number. So they're going to go, what they're doing, and they know that everyone thinks there's a $10,000 rule. So in actual fact, you have more of a chance being questioned transferring $9,000 than $500,000.
Yeah, that's right. It's almost like there's some sort of propaganda out there, or too many people have just read that incoming customs card, that entry card, and they go, no, you can't do that. But online it's okay. You're right. Doing it in those figures, $9,999.99.
I see it on social media every day, and I'll just sit there and I'll just bite my tongue and go, you know, we can only repeat ourselves so many times. And
that's right. That's
Know, after a while, you just, you know, it's that people be stupid and, you know, don't do any homework themselves. But no limit.
That's right. And Brett, I think while we're on the episode, you know, what are we thinking of doing in the next few weeks? I think another webinar is going to be on the
agenda. So what we'll do is just employ everyone to go to our website. When you go to a website for the first time, you'll see a little box in the top left-hand corner. It says allow notifications. Click allow, because anytime we do a blog post, you'll be emailed or you'll get a notification on your computer that we've got something going on. So follow our social media accounts, Atlas Wealth Management. We're on Facebook, we're on LinkedIn, we're on Twitter, Instagram if you want to look at photos, and YouTube. So, you know, all of those channels, we will be broadcasting updates for expats, and some of those updates may be changes regarding super or expat property owners. Certainly, we are going to do another updated webinar, not next Tuesday. I'm just going to look at my... Can you tell me what not next Tuesday, Tuesday after is on...
Tuesday next week, the 14th, you mean the 21st? The 21st of April?
Yeah, so 21st of April, we'll do another webinar following on the same lines of webinar we did last week. And essentially, it will be a brief update from us unless we see some massive changes in the coming weeks. But also, we found that the Q&A session, everyone loved it. So, free-for-all, it was 2 hours, 36 minutes of me just talking. Which, you know, if my wife can't sleep, I just, she just asks me how my day is and I start talking, she goes to sleep, so I don't know. So I'm impressed by people just, they loved it. They just kept feeding on it, which is great because, something we want to do is we have to provide real-time updates and feedback to everyone. And look, that webinar went out to 52 countries. You know, we'll get one set up again for 2 weeks' time and even go bigger again because it's free for everyone and we hope they can get some value out of it.
I think at these times, people have these burning questions, and if they don't have access to individuals like us, they don't have a financial planner or accountant or whatever it might be, it's an easy open forum for them just to shoot through the question. Once we get to it, we get to it. And I dare say you're not the only one with that same question, and you're going to have that question answered, and you've probably solved a lot of other people's problems and issues at the same time.
Exactly. Information, especially in terms of this, is powerful. And just being able to, sometimes you don't have to do anything, but just to know what your options are and to be able to make informed decisions, that to me is the be-all and the end-all.
Yeah, exactly right. All right, Brett, well, why don't we wrap it up there? Obviously, your day is getting started. I know you've got some meetings coming up and mine's winding down. I suppose this will be up pretty soon, I imagine, obviously, on all the socials.
We'll get it up in the next 24 hours, yeah.
Okay. All right, mate. Well, I'll let you go. Another episode, Expat episode 14, Expat Chat, sorry, episode 14. I'll see you on the emails.
That'd be awesome, mate. Take care.
See you, mate. Bye.
See you, mate.